This is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Your feedback helps us know what we're doing right and what we need to work on. Today's podcast comes from a recent debate we held at Reason's DC headquarters about the prospects for liberty in a rapidly diversifying America. Featured National Review's Charles C.W. Cook, Reason's own Shikha Dalmia, and the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunities' Ovik Roy. I served as the evening's moderator. The discussion centered around the question of whether and how libertarians and conservatives can expand their appeal in a country that is becoming more ethnically, culturally, and racially diverse. Historically, the movement for limiting government and expanding individual freedom has been largely white. Yet many of today's hot-button issues, such as immigration, drug policy, and criminal justice reform, don't just pit conservatives and libertarians against one another. They also speak to minorities who are gravely disappointed with liberals and Democrats who attack school choice while dragging their feet on occupational licensing reform and other types of empowerment. This is a lively and often heated discussion in which the participants agree only that old politics and alliances will need to be radically rethought in the era of President Donald Trump. Without further ado, here's the prospects for liberty in a rapidly diversifying America. Okay, we are about to start. I want to thank everybody for coming. I'm Nick Gillespie. I'm the editor-in-chief of Reason.com and Reason TV. There are seats down front if Ron Bailey, look at this. This is the human mind at work, evolution back there, trying to figure out how to open a door. It swings on a hinge. But I want to welcome everybody to Reason's event, which about the prospects for liberty in a rapidly diversifying America. This is a joint operation with the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, which is also calls itself FreeOp, and we'll get into that in a little bit. I just want to very quickly introduce our panelists. The organizer of the event and my Reason colleague, Shikha Dalmia, is here. In the middle is Charles C.W. Cook of National Review Online. He's still, I guess we can still call you relatively the new editor-in-chief of National Review Online. And then Ovik Roy, who is the president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. What we're going to do tonight is each of the panelists is going to talk for about 10 minutes, and then I'll take the moderator's prerogative and ask them a couple of questions. If that fails to get them to come to blows, then we'll open it up to audience questions. But I think we'll get there pretty quickly, and we're hoping to have, I mean, please do participate in the question and answer. How many of you think that immigration and assimilation and acculturation is a serious issue? Okay, at least a few of us, right? One way or the other, right? And look at, we have an actual immigrant here. Quizzically, do you not speak English, Ilya?
I don't speak Gillespie.
I mean, I don't know. And you're wearing a bow tie and an Argyle. He's passing here. He's got an Argyle. Is that a sweater vest? All right, this is a problem. But and I just want to point out before we begin a couple of things.
Argyle socks.
Oh my God! All right, too much information. But you know, one of the things about and I think it's really important. Obviously, Donald Trump ran on a platform of nationalism. He has attracted certain supporters from the so-called alt-right who are talk about things like white nationalism. There is a populist and nationalist movement or kind of sentiment in the air throughout Western Europe or throughout most of Europe and a good chunk of North America and other countries as well. Currently, we've got about 13% of the population of America is foreign-born. That may sound high, but it's the same amount as was in 1860. There was a period between 1940 and 1990 where it was below 10%. And in 1970, how many of you remember 1970? Okay, that was the historic low point for the population, the foreign-born percentage of the population in the United States, and it was actually under 5%. It was 4.7%. And in a lot of ways, I think it's interesting to keep that in mind as a recent benchmark, especially for somebody of Donald Trump's age. He's about 70. The America he grew up in
did not have a lot of recent. It had a lot of immigrants in it, but not recent immigrants. We live in a fundamentally different America where essentially the percentage of foreign-born, including at least two of his three wives, were foreign-born, and it's about tripled since then. The other thing I want to talk about, just as before I turn it over to Shikha to talk, is that the idea of anxiety about what it means to be an American, whether or not we can assimilate immigrants, whether or not foreigners, however we define them, and I suspect that the Native Americans had a slightly different definition of who counted as immigrants and whether or not the English could be assimilated or the Spanish, than the English did later. But back in 1782, and I have this, here we go. Jean de Crèvecoeur, who wrote a collection of letters. He was a French-born farmer in upstate New York. He was a slave owner and also one of the first articulators of an American creed where the American identity was one of mixing and mongrelization and hybridization and kind of bastardization. But in 1782, he wrote in his most famous letter from an American farmer, "What then is the American, this new man?" he asked. "He is either a European or the descendant of a European, hence that strange mixture of blood which you will find in no other country. I could point out to you a family whose grandfather was an Englishman, whose wife was Dutch, whose son married a French woman, and whose four sons have four wives of different nations. He is an American who, leaving behind him all his ancient prejudices and manners, receives new ones from the new mode of life he has embraced." So, at the very origins of the country, there is this sense that we are a country of immigrants that is constantly mixing. The mix changes. He's saying, well, Americans are only European. Obviously, immigrants who are coming to America now are primarily not from Europe. Ovik and I were talking about this. The two largest groups are South Asians and East Asians coming. They actually outnumber Hispanics or Latinos coming to the country now. But there is both a sense that this is what defines America, and it creates a huge amount of anxiety about whether or not we can actually survive or persist as a kind of coherent nation with that. So that's what we're going to be talking about. And then we're adding on top of that, and specifically in the question as Shikha framed it, is, what are the prospects for liberty? Reason is a libertarian organization. Charles wrote a great book called The Conservatarian Manifesto. He's a libertarian. We'll give him time. Once his green card comes through, he can admit to being a libertarian. And Ovik has many, many libertarian sympathies as well. But one of the great arguments that is made against the new immigrants, and this was made against the Italians and the Jews and the Poles in the 19-teens and whatnot, but is that, the problem with the immigrants coming now is that they don't care about, good core American values, about limited government. They're just going to vote for welfare, or they are authoritarian, and they just want a strong man, et cetera. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Shikha, take it away, please.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thanks to Charles and Ovik, my co-conspirators here. We actually conceived this panel before the election, and we thought we would be addressing a very different political reality. So apologies for that. But, before I begin, I just want to apologize to all the white people over here about what I'm just about to say. I really do love you, and I eat hamburgers all the time. So Nick has actually laid it out pretty well, but this panel is, as I've conceived it, it was less about immigration, really, and more about how do we think about minorities as a group, and not just minorities, which includes immigrants, but not exclusively immigrants. And what do we do in this rapidly diversifying America to bring liberty to minorities? So with that in mind, let me just begin. There has long been this sentiment on the conservative right that if there is a guardian of America's traditions of limited government, free market, individual responsibility, and liberty, it is largely the white Christian establishment. The early settlers founded America to escape religious persecution, built it by the sweat of their brows, and then their descendants paid with their blood to win their freedom from the tyrannical English king. But no hard feelings, Charlie. They're all good here. They authored the Constitution and the Bill of Rights with its guarantee of free speech and religious liberty to guard against an overweening government. Hence, an ethos of self-reliance and liberty is woven into the cultural DNA that has made America unique, exceptional. By contrast, minorities and immigrants raised in non-Western socialistic or illiberal polities dilute this commitment. They succumb too easily to the lure of the welfare handouts and vote for big government Democrats rather than take their rewards and lumps in the free market. They don't have any serious appreciation for the Constitution, so if you allow them here in large numbers, they'll undermine America's principles. And yet, when the closest thing this country has seen to an actual authoritarian arrives on the scene in the person of Donald Trump, what happens? The minorities don't vote him to the White House, the whites do. So I would argue that after this election, it is time to retire the fairy tale that white America is a unique guardian of American traditions and non-white minorities a unique threat. In fact, if liberty has a future in America, it is because of its diversity. And the diverser it gets, the freer it will remain. To say that Trump has a strong authoritarian and anti-constitutional streak in him is an understatement. And Charlie actually has provided a pretty good laundry list of Trump's tyrannical effusions. As per Charlie, Trump has threatened to shut down parts of the internet, pledged to deport illegal immigrants without due process, endorsed extensive campaign finance regulations, vowed to restrict the Second Amendment rights of those on the terror watch list, again without due process, praised FDR's internment camps of American citizens, suggested that natural-born Americans be deported against their will, proposed that American Muslims be barred from re-entering the country, described as wonderful the Supreme Court's Kelo ruling sanctioning the government's eminent domain powers to take private property, refused to rule out registering Americans on the basis of their faith. To this, one can also add his calls for a federal death penalty for cop killers, expanded use of stop and frisk, doubling down on the drug war that has turned America into an incarceration state, abandoning criminal justice reform, and a lot more. Now, when Charlie offered his laundry list back in March, Trump had the allegiance of 30% of GOP primary voters, which Charlie rightly felt at that time was an unmitigated disaster. Trump, of course, went on to win by 58% of the white vote, but he got less Hispanic, Asian American, and black vote than any winning president in the last 40 years. Now, it's unclear whether Trump won the white vote despite or because of his authoritarian tendencies. But it is clear that what appealed to the white voters most about Trump was his message of economic nationalism and his promise to protect their jobs from the vagaries of the free market through his protectionist and restrictionist policies. Trump's carrier deal is wildly popular with voters and more so with Republicans than Democrats. 57% of Republicans now agree that the free market has been sorting out the economy and America has been losing. Only 37% of Democrats now believe that. Also, 53% of Republicans strongly favor taxes on companies that move American jobs to other countries, compared to 43% of Democrats. Now, all of this shows that this wanted cultural DNA notwithstanding, white America has displayed no special commitment to market competition and limited government, nor any special antipathy to government intervention and handouts to protect its interests. What's more, in order to protect its privileges, it is willing to overlook Trump's authoritarian tendencies, even if it doesn't agree with them. So the question then becomes, who will stand up for American constitutional traditions in Trump's America? And the answer, in my opinion, is America's myriad minorities, for the simple reason that they'll bear the brunt of Trump's excesses, precisely because whites think that they can do better in Trump's America by weakening the Constitution's limits on power. Minorities will need the Constitution more than ever in order to guard against the tyranny of the majority and protect their due process, property, free speech rights, basic civil liberties, what have you. This is exactly what James Madison actually envisioned in the Federalist 10. And if he pointed out that so long as the reason of man remains fallible and he is at liberty to exercise it, powerful factions will try to secure their interests by using the strong arm of the government. However, the solution wasn't, in his view, to give every citizen the same opinion by trying, for example, to create a homogeneous population, as many cultural conservatives want. It was to expand the republic's size and population in order to multiply the factions. Freedom arises from the multiplicity of sects, he remarked. Now, why did Madison think that? Essentially, because a pluralist democracy with multiple factions has multiple interests, and when there are multiple interests, it becomes hard for the tyrant to unite them behind a singular and enduring agenda for the simple reason that there are too many losers who can mobilize against him. The worst tyrannical excesses, even in a constitutional republic, happen when a majority is overwhelmingly dominant and minorities too weak to actually invoke the protections they are afforded. Think about how racially imbalanced America was during the Jim Crow era. Nor were the blacks the only ones being oppressed at that time. Asians and blacks in California could not testify against a white witness in the mid-1800s, limiting their legal defense of white aggression against them. When there are lots of minorities, they can invoke the protections that a polity extends them through courts, protests, or press to much greater effect. In the process, they remind the majority of its allegiance to its own principles that it's supposed to live by, thereby strengthening them. A reliance on diversity then is built into the American constitutional scheme. Our founders were not sentimental about attachment to limited government or an ideology of libertarianism. They had a different way of producing liberty. But diversity and immigration, which is one source of it, will help protect not just our political liberty, but our economic liberty as well. Trump's working class white base may feel its livelihood threatened by immigration and trade, but neither of these things are the real cause of America's middle class job losses. If there is a culprit, it's actually automation, and it has claimed 88% of job losses in America, according to a recent Ball State University study. Now, imagine this erosion of the middle class happening not in a diverse and open America, but a homogeneous one. You'd basically have a situation in which poor white lower class would sit staring at the rich white upper class. The opportunity and mobility in this society would be hard to discern. The likely result would be seething class resentment that would eventually explode in some combination of Luddite and a Jacobin backlash. But when markedly diverse immigrants who come to America with every strike against them, little capital, no connections, no familiarity with how the system works, manage to reach the higher rungs of American society in short order, then opportunity and mobility are rendered visible to all. It becomes very hard to argue that the American dream is not alive, that capitalism depends upon exploiting those in the bottom rungs. The fact that two people of color and two people with accents can sit over here and opine to you all becomes living testimony of America's promise. Minorities and diversity are not the source but the solution to America's problems. But the question, of course, is how does one channel the self-interested constitutional activism that I think we are going to see in the near future into a coherent and enduring agenda for limited government and free market? Trump may have won without minority support this time, but even Sean Trend, the analyst who coined the missing white voter thesis, who basically said that Mitt Romney lost not necessarily because minorities didn't vote for him, but because 6 million whites stayed at home, doesn't really think that Republicans can win maybe for more than another two election cycles because they are going to be a plurality by 2040. So the question for our country is, how does one win minorities to a broader freedom agenda? And the answer is not by doing what conservatives, the alleged guardians of these ideals, have historically done. Orvik has talked about how the Republican Party after 1964 Civil Rights Act essentially became the party for channeling white grievances. But if conservatives have had little appeal to minorities, it is not only because they have shown little interest in reaching out to them. They have historically had a finely articulated and very targeted critique of every minority's pathology. Hispanics are welfare queens who are resistant to assimilation. Muslims are Sharia lovers incapable of embracing liberalism. Black men are crime prone. But when it comes to improving the lot of these groups, they offer generic remedies like tax cuts and deregulation. Worse, liberals typically show minorities the good side of big government and conservatives the bad side of limited government. Liberals want to give minorities welfare, and Republicans want them to pee in cups to test for drugs to qualify for it. Liberals want to offer high-risk inner-city kids head start. Conservatives want to throw their dads in jail for drug dealing in the name of law and order. Nor will reaching out to minorities by banding abstract appeals to freedom and limited government work, which is kind of the libertarian tendency. The politics of minorities, like those of white majority, as we have seen, are pragmatic. We need to develop a value proposition for them based on our principles that are relevant to their concerns and lives. Show them the nice side of limited government. Hispanics may not turn down liberal food stamps, but they have more use for a party that offers their Mexican kin a usable guest worker program. Chinese tiger moms who are extremely serious about their kids' education may not march against federal aid to local public schools, but they might actually like a party that offers them school vouchers better. Sikh emigres that fled India for Canada during a persecutory chapter in their country's history didn't sneer at liberal offers of stimulus dollars to build temples in Canada. They actually flocked to Tories, and this is actually true, more because Tories asserted a bedrock commitment to religious liberty and tolerance. For a while, Tories in Canada were winning the minority and immigrant vote overwhelmingly without playing Santa. The point is that minorities are by no means the settled enemies of limited government they are claimed to be. Without doubt, they can be attracted to social programs, but not noticeably more than whites in the same economic situation. These social programs, moreover, are not the only road to government overreach. There is also economic protectionism, overreactions to domestic dangers like terrorism and drug abuse, various kinds of nationalism and jingoism. The dangers of the welfare state are not obviously greater than those of the crony capitalist state, national security state, the law and order state. And in the face of these dangers, minorities might be natural allies of liberty. They are not in any greater inherent tension with limited government than whites. The tension points are just different, as are the opportunities. The challenge for the politics of freedom is to exploit those opportunities and not sweat the tension points too much.
Thank you very much, Shikha. And now, Charles?
Thank you. Well, I agree with a lot of that, and I disagree with a lot of that. I think it is probably true. They're after me already, you see. It's Trump. It's the Trump era. I better get that green card.
I called ICE. So.
I knew this was a trap.
By the way, only two of the three up there are immigrants, and there's going to be a test later.
So everything that I said about Trump, I still believe, and I'm pleased you read that out. Because since he won, I've been accused of insufficient opposition. But he hasn't done anything yet, so I probably need a few weeks. I think it is fair to say that it will be minorities among others who oppose Trump. But I think that needs to be seen within the context of how American politics works, more than that there is a problem with white people or a problem with minorities or something good about white people or something good about minorities, in that all of the parade of horribles that I put in the piece that you cited, with the exception of two, I think, also applied to the Democratic Party in this election. I mean, attacks on the First Amendment, a desire to undermine the Second Amendment. Trump, his position on terror watch lists is appalling, but it's precisely the same position President Obama holds, Harry Reid holds, Hillary Clinton held. And so if we're to indict those who either indulge that or encourage that, we need to indict those on the other side too. And that was a majority in this election of minority voters. And had Hillary Clinton, as I thought was going to happen, won, it would have been white people in Iowa who would have pushed back against those things. If, as seems likely, they now indulge it because their guy is doing it, which is one of the big problems we have in politics, it will be minorities who are doing that pushback, but not because they're standing on any particular principle, but because people are hypocritical and short-sighted and tribal. And I think the same thing goes for economic nationalism, too. I mean, Donald Trump is a real problem for a free marketeer such as myself. But President Obama coined this horrifically Orwellian phrase, economic patriotism. It is a sentiment you hear on the left as well. And in fact, on this one, if there is a party that stands generally for free markets, it is the Republicans, although they are bad in many ways, too. So I just think we ought to be careful not to ascribe values to either white or non-white people that are more the product of general political dynamics. In terms of the future, I mean, I'll come on to immigration, which I don't think we can avoid. I take an almost nihilistic view of this last election in that I'm not sure it means a great deal. We do seem to be rooting for laundry now in America. Republicans vote for Republicans, Democrats vote for Democrats. There are a few people who are persuadable. And many of the people who are persuadable, it has to be said, don't have very strong political views. I mean, we've all spoken to somebody who said, the two people I'm really interested in this coming election are Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. And you think, how can you see them as being remotely similar? But a lot of voters do. They don't hold the same strong views we do, and they're not weirdos like we are, spending our evenings talking about politics in a room. So I'm worried about Trump, and I'm worried about what he could do to liberty, and I'm worried about what his nomination said about the Republican Party, about conservatism, about America. And I'm also not worried about it because I'm not entirely convinced the election would have looked too different if, say, Scott Walker had been the nominee. I'm not entirely convinced the election would have looked too different if Marco Rubio had been the nominee. Not that it would have been precisely the same, but most of the people who line up on either side would have continued to do so. But the way we see it would have been very different. We would have said, well, look at the, if it had been Rubio, we'd have said, look at this young Hispanic guy. It's the new Republican Party. It's a Republican Party that's trying to reach minorities. It's a Republican Party that is comfortable in this new America. But most of the same people would have voted for that party, and I do think that's worth remembering. And I do think it's worth remembering that one of the reasons Trump won is that Hillary Clinton was a shockingly bad candidate. And I can't game out exactly what would have happened with other Republican candidates, but that has to be acknowledged in any analysis. One thing I think we ought to stop doing, therefore, is to say, well, and Republicans and conservatives need to stop doing this too, is to say, well, Trump won because of this, to everything. We see this constantly now. Whatever our pet project is, whatever our pet peeve is, someone will say, well, I think we should have slightly higher marginal tax rates, and conservatives sneer, that's exactly why Trump won. Is it? He didn't win in a landslide. He barely won. He won. I'm an advocate of the Electoral College, but he won just about. The GOP in general ran ahead of him. Minority candidates tended to run ahead of him, Republican minority candidates. Marco Rubio, I think, won Florida by 10 points, was it? If he had won a massive 49-state blowout, if he had won by 10 million votes, at that point, we could start drawing sweeping conclusions as to what it says about the country. But he didn't. And again, one of the reasons many Americans who don't like him voted for him is because, for better or for worse, and whether they're right or wrong, a lot of them thought that Hillary Clinton would have been worse. Meghan McArdle made a great point recently in which she pointed out that for minorities, the nomination of Donald Trump felt like an existential threat, and I absolutely acknowledge that. But she also said that for many religious people, the direction the Democratic Party has taken recently felt like an existential threat. Once you start looking at the election in that way, and I think a lot of it was people voting against other people rather than for, again, I think the meaning is diminished. So I want to quickly talk about where I think the Republican Party has done well and where I think the Liberty is going, and then briefly touch on immigration, then I'll be quiet. I think that there are both encouraging and discouraging signs for liberty and for harmony in America. One of the least well-reported stories of the election was Senator Rubio going into majority black precincts and asking for their vote. And in a few cases, he won majority of the black vote in a few precincts. Ed Gillespie in Virginia had the amazing and brilliant and new idea of actually asking Asian Americans to vote for him, which Republicans don't do very well, which conservatives don't do very well. And he did. Now, that is not a strategy that Donald Trump employed. And it's not a strategy that many people who like Donald Trump employed. But they're in the same party. So again, I want to be careful that we don't tar this very large, diverse, fractured country with the same brush. You can put people off if you speak in a particular way, and you can encourage people to vote for you if you speak in a particular way, even if your policies are substantively identical. On the question of immigration, I think we disagree very strongly on this. And again, not because I'm a particularly strong immigration restrictionist, but because just as a matter of policy, I think there are a number of rational reasons to worry about immigration that really have nothing to do with race. I'm an immigrant. I'm from a mixed-race family, not my parents, as you can see. But I have a cousin from Malawi. My sister married a gentleman from Malaysia. We live in a very small village in England where I'm from, and it's we look strange on Christmas Day, I'll put it that way. We're not exactly like all the other families. And I'm still more of an immigration restrictionist than many, probably most in this room, because I think that countries are fragile. And I think unlike goods and services, unlike drugs, for example, people can vote, people can change cultures. Now, again, I don't think that that can be easily broken down into white and non-white. Some of the most vehement immigration restrictionists in the United States are African Americans. Some of the most vehement immigration restrictionists in the United States are actually immigrants or the children of immigrants themselves. Immigrant is not a category. Immigrant is a descriptor, but it's not a category. There's a tendency, I think, among many libertarians to cast immigration as almost a threshold issue, and that if liberty-loving candidates don't suggest that they are for immigration in an unlimited sense, that they will never be palatable to minority voters. And I don't think that's true. And I don't think that it is illiberal to be skeptical toward immigration. There was a quote from Nick from the early Republic. But Thomas Jefferson was obviously pretty influential in the early Republic, and he worried about this too. So did Alexander Hamilton. And I won't go over my time, but I think we ought to be very careful on that question not to cast legitimate policy disagreements as part of some larger culture or racial war. America has gone through periods of a great deal of immigration, and it's gone through periods of very little immigration, and the amount of liberty accorded to American citizens has gone up and down throughout that period. These relationships are a lot more complicated, I think, than both left and right will concede.
Thank you very much, Charles. And now up in, well, not quite clean up, but batting third, Ovik Roy, and you were born in Michigan, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, so we're flipping the cards. He's the American.
Born from Detroit. Yeah.
If you consider Michigan part of America, which, you know.
Sometimes we call ourselves, what is it, the 14th province of Canada when it comes to hockey anyway. On Twitter, during the election season, I had people on Twitter telling me to go back to India, and I had to explain to them that that I was born outside of Detroit, and they responded, well, technically, India is outside of Detroit. both Charlie and Shika alluded to the problem, if one thinks of it as a problem, of minorities not voting for Republicans. Often, many of us in this room, I'm sure all of us at one point or another have had multiple occasions conversations with our friends who are in the liberty movement, you know, wondering how to address the problem of, say, the fact that African Americans vote against Republicans if one is more Republican in one's sympathies by a ratio of 90 to 10 or plus or minus, right? In this most recent election, it was 89 to 11, I believe, or something like that. And there is a significant cohort of conservatives and libertarians who will say, if you ask, you point this out, that, well, there's really no point in trying to reach out to the black vote. The fact is that African Americans are disproportionately poor. They're on welfare. They benefit from the welfare state, and that's why they vote for the party of the welfare state. I want to tell a story from a good 57 years ago or so. There were two students in Georgia, Charlene Hunter and Hamilton Holmes, who were two of the top students at the elite all-black segregated high school in Atlanta called Turner High School. They applied to college at the University of Georgia, but at that time, the University of Georgia, a state university, was segregated, and so they were rejected, as all black applicants were. An NAACP lawyer took on their case and sued under Brown v. Board of Education, a law that many people think of as an incredible and unconstitutional intrusion of the federal government into states' prerogatives. And based on the Brown v. Board of Education precedent, these two students won their case and they were admitted to the University of Georgia. They came in January of 1961, and when they got to campus, a riot broke out. Students started chanting 2, 4, 6, 8, "We don't want to desegregate." And for 2 hours, students threw bricks and bottles on fire into their dormitories, ran rampant around campus, and finally, after 2 hours, police decided to come in and put a stop to the riots. After the riots were over, the university took disciplinary action, not against the rioters, but against the two black students. They were suspended from the University of Georgia for being threats to public safety on campus. A few months after this case happened, and it got national attention, this was widely reported in the New York Times, Washington Post, television news, etc., as a symbol of racial division in America. Barry Goldwater came to Atlanta and gave a speech to a group of white swing voters and said, "I will bend every muscle I have so that the South has a voice in all affairs that affect the South." Everybody knew what he meant when he said that. And now we all think of Barry Goldwater and know of Barry Goldwater, someone who's a card-carrying member of the NAACP, someone who genuinely cared about racial harmony. And yet, at best, he was so committed to his view of the 10th Amendment and states' rights that he was willing to accept racial violence against black Americans in Georgia to attract the votes of white Southerners. We now ask ourselves, why is it that black Americans don't vote Republican? Well, black Americans did used to vote Republican. They used to vote majority Republican. Then starting around the time of the New Deal, they started to vote a little bit less Republican, 30-40%. And then after the 1964 campaign of Barry Goldwater, they started voting in the teens or the high single digits for Republican. Rather than, I think it's interesting that instead of we say that, well, the reason why blacks don't vote Republicans because they want free stuff. We don't think it's because there are posters of Barry Goldwater on the walls of the Reason magazine editorial offices. And we don't wonder why it is that we lionize someone who, for a very significant part of the American population, is best known for his opposition to laws that would have protected them from massive restrictions of their liberty and their civil rights. In fact, Barry Goldwater, in a conscience of, the conscience of a conservative, argued that there was no such thing as civil rights in the concept, in the context of the black problem. That there was no such thing as civil rights unless there was a law passed that created civil rights, but that there were no inherent civil rights unless there was an actual law protecting the liberties of blacks. And he, in this case, opposed those laws because he found them to be unconstitutional intrusions on state prerogatives. And so we have a very significant part of the U.S. population who actually is very committed to the concept of liberty. But for them, the federal government has been the guarantors of their liberty, not states or localities. And because the modern American conservative movement has been more committed to the prerogatives of states and localities than to the liberty of blacks, blacks don't vote Republican. And rather than confront that history, that the patron saint of the modern American conservative movement, at least in the political sphere, maybe not in the literary sphere, was an exponent, an advocate of being indifferent to that problem, at least politically. He would say, no, I'm really concerned about segregation. I'm really concerned about racial violence. I oppose all those things. This is what Barry Goldwater would say. I just don't want to pass any laws to do anything about it at the federal level. And I, believe me, I don't mean to minimize the importance of the 10th Amendment. I don't mean to minimize the fact that the Constitution has been a protector of our liberties, broadly speaking. But if we think about liberty qua liberty, we have to acknowledge that a technical exegesis of the Constitution has not always served the interests of liberty for very important populations in the United States. When we talk about Donald Trump, and we have, you know, we've had this Never Trump movement, we've had this this worry that Donald Trump is bringing out sentiments that that were heretofore not expressed in the public square, and how really terrible that is. I think that that's really the wrong way to think about it. The fact is that to whatever degree there were dark sentiments of the alt-right that have come to the fore today, well, maybe they're doing us a service by being explicit about their sentiments. It's not that they didn't exist before 2016. It's just that they weren't explicit, perhaps, on Twitter or other venues as to their sentiments. But they were a significant part of the Republican coalition. You know, we complain sometimes that, well, the Democrats don't really do anything about school reform because the teachers' unions have a veto on what Democrats do. Well, there are certain parties and interest groups that have coalitions that have a veto power over how Republicans behave as well. And so you hear people say, well, how can you say the Republican Party has issues? There's Marco Rubio, there's Nikki Haley, there's Tim Scott. There are all these great examples of diverse people who support freedom. And that's great, and that's encouraging. And I worked for Marco Rubio, and I am proud to have done so. But I think that we have failed to appreciate that just because most Republicans and most conservatives and most libertarians are good people, that doesn't mean that an angry, resentful small minority can't drive the political decisions and rhetoric of elected officials. And that's a real problem. And it's a problem that's amplified by the fact that we in our movement celebrate people who oppose liberty for minorities at a time when it really mattered. And that's something that we have to confront. It's something that we have to transcend. And I don't think that we've done that. And if we want to wonder why Donald Trump sometimes has amplified sentiments that we don't approve of in that regard, I think we have to look at the mirror and see how our own movement has laid the groundwork for a coalition that we look at and don't always like.
Thank you. Thank you all three. That is great.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please remember to subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Your feedback helps us know what we're doing right and what we need to work on.